Today, we have Mr. Pink, and we have Hydra, also known as Simon... Simon, what's your name?
Schnitzler. Simon Schnitzler.
are you from the Schnitzel fortune that invented Schnitzel?
Sadly not. I think Schnitzel actually comes from Vienna. And
oh, shit.
Schnitzler is probably more known, the author. Maybe you've all seen Eyes Wide Shut. That's a spin-off movie from a book from the author, Arthur Schnitzler.
I'm not surprised that someone with your last name wrote that movie.
And the book is supposed to be even more scarier than the movie.
I didn't even know the movie was scary. I thought it was sexy.
Yes, well, it was disturbing sex, yeah. And he was that kind of guy.
Well, we're not talking about sexy things. Well, maybe we are talking about sexy things today. But I wanted to talk about sculpting, if that's cool with you guys.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So, first question, who out of the three of us started sculpting at the youngest age? It doesn't have to be exact.
Oh. Simon, do you remember when you first started sculpting? It also doesn't have to be miniatures. It could be anything.
Oh, well, then it's probably kindergarten. With this non-settling clay, I don't know the English word.
Oh, plasticine?
Yeah, that stuff.
What do you call it in Germany?
Knete. That comes from when you have dough and you knead the dough.
We use knead and we use a K with it, so clearly that's where it came from.
Mr. Pink, where did you first start sculpting?
I think we probably all played with something like plasticine in kindergarten. I remember having a neighbor across the street sculpt something out of Silly Putty, and I remember being really amazed by that he could make this cool thing out of Silly Putty, and I think, God, I would have been younger than 10, maybe?
For me, our primary school had like an after school classes, and I signed up for play with clay, or it was plasticine, and it was just like an hour after school. They would just be like, make whatever the hell you want. That's where I really started to sculpt stuff.
And it's a bit ridiculous because Brother Pink is like the most prodigious sculptor out of any of us. Does crazy ass clay sculpting and has done for years.
I haven't actually for a year.
I actually have to say about starting sculpting. As some know, I'm an art teacher. I have this in the upper classes, like 17, 16-year-old kids. They first really get into contact with sculpting stuff. And, of course, the most difficult thing is sculpting faces. And I had my 17-year-olds start sculpting faces. And my class, which is kids around 10, I had them start sculpting faces at the same time, and since the older kids didn't get into contact with sculpting at their age, there was no big quality difference between those two classes. That was amazing, because I think when you start sculpting early in school in art classes, you really can do that. Some teachers are hesitant to that because they think, oh, sculpting, of course, the material is most of the time expensive, at least compared to watercolors. But I think it's really worth it because small kids go forward to approach this technique a different way than the older kids. The older kids start to get frustrated really quickly, like, oh, this should really look like a face, and it doesn't. And the small kids are like, oh, yeah, that's good enough for me. I'm cool with that. And they learn faster.
One thing I really liked about Simon's story is that I think it illustrates that you can start sculpting whenever the hell you want, that you don't have to have had sculpting training to get going at it, that a 17-year-old and a 10-year-old are at the exact same point as long as they just start.
Yeah, and also, like, ability is really weird with sculpting. Like, the Perry brothers used to sculpt for Games Workshop, and one of them lost his arm in a car accident, and he's, like, still a prodigious sculptor.
And the crazy thing about that story is that, well, I heard it differently. I thought he lost his arm in a reenactment scene where they shot off a cannon and he kind of lost his arm to that accident because something exploded.
Oh, my God.
That's the urban myth?
I think it was written down in the White Dwarf at some point. He was doing everything with his right hand and he lost his right hand and he had to learn everything on the other side. And some say that his sculpting now is better than it was before.
Interesting, because you have the chance to start again.
Yep.
What is that? Did you hear that?
I don't know. It sounds like a German notification.
Yes, it was my PC. Sorry for that.
It's okay.
My interest sculpting models I think it really stems from being a 90s kid and growing up at a time where we're being bombarded with so many crazy action figures all the time. You stare at the sculpture, basically. It can move and stuff, but you're staring at it so intently. And I'm wondering if you have any, like, early memories surrounding action figures that inspired you based on their sculpt.
I would like to introduce you to my room right now, because I'm not recalling any memories of that time, but I'm sitting in the middle of a huge collection of these memories, because my favorite action figures brand was He-Man and Masters of the Universe. And at some point in my adult life, I started collecting them. And now I have them on display in all of my room. I'm the firstborn, and my parents were really unsure of how they should educate me. And so they got these magazines, how to be a parent and stuff like that. There was a warning article in one of those magazines, which was warning parents about how evil and manipulating the merchandise system behind Masters of the Universe was. And to show the parents how ugly and evil those action figures were, there was a colored double side of those figures standing in a small diorama. I was sitting on my mother's lap when she flipped through this magazine, and she read this article, and that was fascinating by this colorful double pages. And when she put this magazine away and I was left on my own to play, I sneaked into her bedroom looking through all those magazines until I found this double side full color page of Masters of the Universe, and I was staring at it for ages. And I was so fascinated by all those monsters and all that stuff that my parents decided that I was never going to be allowed to have any of this evil, child-twisting, manipulating thing. And so it was a really long time until I got my first Master of the Universe, because I started seeing my friends more at their place, because, of course, they all had all those figures. And I wasn't allowed to have any, so I always had to go to my friends to play with their toys. And at some point, my parents decided that it was unavoidable to get me at least one of them, so I could have one, and then this thing would be over.
And they got you She-Ra.
No, I got the... No, even worse. I got the most scariest of them all. It was Stondar, the one who could turn into a stone. There were all these cool monsters, Skeletor and all those Snake Man and those wide-eyed monster things, and I got the stone.
Whatever, we got Moss Man.
Yeah, but Moss Man was scary.
He got even scarier when somebody covered him in lighter fluid and lit him on fire.
Did we actually do that? Did I do that? No, I feel like we still have him and he's still intact, but maybe I'm hallucinating.
No, he was part of those action figures that were lost during your pyro phase.
Good to know that Mr. Pink had a pyro phase. I was always fascinated with the monsters. The good guys were okay, but I was always playing the bad guys, because the variety of them was so large. If you look at the quantity of miniatures, you have the good guys, and there are about, I don't know, 15 different good guys, and there are three times more bad guys. And I was always fascinated with these skulls and monsters and large teeth and... I don't know, all this creepy stuff. And I think that when I turned to tabletop, that struck back.
If you also think about the guys making those action figures, the guys who have to make, like, all the bare-chested, like, white guys with the blonde hair, like, that's probably the shittiest job you get. Like, oh, God, I have to do another human face. And then it's like, you look at the guy over there who's making, like, 18 monsters, and they only asked him to make one monster, and he's like, okay, this guy's head spins around, this guy's covered in moss, and this guy's like a big stone, like, oh, I got so many ideas. How about you over there, George? This guy's got giant tits, this guy's got giant tits, this guy's got giant tits. That's about it.
But those giant tits were reused, weren't they? Weren't all the bad guy models, didn't they all have the exact same chest sculpt?
Even Moss Man was basically like a He-Man covered in flock.
That's another fascinating thing. When you look at those, especially the early series of Masters of the Universe, Mattel didn't want to put much money into that brand, which is ridiculous because it became so popular. But you have miniatures being reused and appear differently by a different paint job. Like, Mossman is the same miniature as Beastman, but Mossman is simply covered in flock. Or you have Stinkor who is the skunk guy who is smelling so wonderfully. And you have mermen, who are basically the same miniatures. So their task was, in the beginning, to sculpt something that was interchangeable and reusable.
I feel like Simon should do a documentary on this one day.
There are enough documentaries about that already. But I feel it's really inspiring, because some companies kind of, when you look into a tabletop thing, this interchangeability is something, it's really challenging for a sculptor, because you, on the one side, you have to create something unique and remarkable, and people should want to buy it. On the other side, it should be able to be turned into something else. And I think this is a really huge task to fulfill.
It's interesting that you talk about action figures, because I'd never really thought about action figures as sculptures, but I guess they are. And then when Simon was talking about action figures, he called them miniatures. And I'm like, well, I never thought about that either, that these were like giant miniatures that we were playing with as kids.
What were some of your favorite toys as a kid?
Oh, I guess, are you trying to get at Battle Beasts? I guess that was something that was pretty cool.
You think I've got these set of questions? I'm not trying to get at anything.
Well, it's because you do them so well. When we were kids, we had these Battle Beast things. I don't know, Simon, if you had them in Germany.
Yes.
But they're these little animal guys that have armor. And they would be actually miniature size. They'd be a little larger than a space marine, I guess. We had a lot of those when we were kids, and I loved them. So they were pretty cool. They're based on animals. Most of them had these little cupped hands that you could put plastic weapons into. Some of them had, like, little weapon hands. And I remember loving that. And just the color of them, that they would have this kind of, like, power armor. The animals would be very colorful, and then their armor would be a different color. And this is something, like, Simon talks about collecting Masters of the Universe. There's still a big, like, collection community online for Battle Beasts. So yeah, I don't know if they influenced my sculpting, but I really loved Battle Beasts when I was a kid, and so maybe that was proto-Warhammer for me.
Also, the cool thing, Battle Beasts had, like, really limited range of motion. Only thing that they could do is their arms would basically turn at the shoulder socket, and that was it. They were static.
Yeah, they just swing up and down.
Because they're so small, you don't really care that they can't bend their legs or whatever.
Well, you're a kid. You just move them around. Who cares?
But I think it's the thing about size, too. Like, even with Warhammer, it's so small that you don't give a shit that they don't move. If the figures were much bigger, you'd be like, what? I'm just paying this. Like a Gundam. A Gundam model has to have that articulation because it's at a certain size. But Warhammer and miniature games are so small that just seeing something that small, you don't really care at that size if it's going to be able to bend its arms or twist its hips or whatever.
I think this idea that it shouldn't be moving goes that far that I always felt weird when people magnetize anything on their models. And it kind of gains a mobility, like, oh yeah, I can interchange my my weapons or my tank because I have magnets on that, but I also can rotate them. It always felt a little weird.
I just magnetized a torso on a gunner for a speeder, and it's weird. It's like, oh shit, I can like twist them over here or twist them over here, wherever the target is. And I'm like, oh no, that's not right. That's not right at all.
Is it the third wall or something that you, like, break the suspension of disbelief and tell the audience that you know they're there? This is not exactly that, but I feel like it's some kind of weird miniature-based uncanny valley where it's like, no, miniatures are static. They're not action figures, and this makes them feel like action figures.
I think with Games Workshop going into this Titan-sized thing, they're kind of reproducing very expensive large action figures that somehow kind of should move, but on the other hand shouldn't move.
I think maybe it's that scale thing where if it gets that big, you start feeling like it's a toy and not a miniature.
Gotta have something to show if it's that big. For me, G.I. Joes were like the main toy. I think a lot of people who are into like miniature war games, they get to a point where they start seeing the world around them, like go to a dollar store and like, oh, that could be good terrain. And like they kind of look at a snowbank. They're like, oh, I could put some miniatures on here. But I had that starting with G.I. Joe where I'd be like, oh man, if my G.I. Joes were here, they'd just be like running in the bushes or digging in the sand. So you kind of like put your mind into looking at the world at a different scale. So that was one thing that kind of got me started.
What I thought about earlier that I didn't mention was with Battle Beasts, we had friends across the street that had this really cool kind of like rock garden in the front yard. And I remember vividly when we were playing with Battle Beasts as kids, we would go into that rock garden and we would build these little bridges between the different rocks using twigs and sticks. And then we'd have, like, the Battle Beast, like, fight across these things. And that is definitely proto-Warhammer.
And also, that was always in commercials for, like, every action figure in the 90s. Where it's like, the guy's standing on a twig bridge. He's going to fire a missile at it. Oh, it blew up. He fell off the bridge. Like, you were kind of almost led to act that way through TV commercials.
Yeah, and it's funny that on the one side, playing tabletop is basically nothing else than playing with your action figures, but we're having rules now which settle who's going to die and who isn't. I had the same thing, that when something was broken, I went to my dad and said, oh yeah, I got this toy and it's broken. And I had this, I think it was a Pterodactylus dinosaur miniature, which had a really long neck, and the neck broke off. So it was headless, and I went to my dad and said, oh yeah, can you repair this for me, because I really love this dinosaur. And he was like, yeah, sure. And I left it with my dad, and after a while he said, well, yeah, here, I got it fixed. And when I came back, he, since he didn't know anything about plastic glue or pinning, he took the next best idea he had and melted it together. So he took a torch to both ends and melted it together. Yeah. It resulted in a pterodactylus without a neck. But it looked like he was wearing a real big scarf. And I was like, Dad, it looks crappy. And he said, well, this dinosaur has measles now. And I never played with it again.
Good on your dad for thinking of that.
Yeah. I think I never took anything to repair to my dad afterwards.
That's the thing, though. Like, when you're a kid and you want somebody to fix it, you want it to be returned to the exact same condition as it was before. But, like, you're going to damage it in some way to make it one piece again. And it's not easy being a parent.
I guess our kids will be really lucky because we know way more about glue and pinning and all those and all that stuff than our parents did.
Yeah, I'm worried our kids are not going to play with models. They're going to play with computers.
No, they won't. It will break their fingers.
Just enough so that they can't type, but not enough that they can't hold a action figure.
I don't know anything about computers.
I don't know if I did any, like, sculpting to do with play, but I remember as a kid that we were playing this video game Secret of Mana for Super Nintendo, and we really liked it so much that we actually started sculpting the little, like, characters from the game using Fimo, I think. I guess that's kind of like an extension of play using sculpting. We did a pretty good job, too. They were pretty simple, but whatever.
But it's important to start at some point. The result doesn't matter that much.
Because we didn't do it. I think we should do a thing where Simon introduces himself and talks about, like, his history in the hobby.
Okay, sure. Shit. I'm going to call him Mr. Schnitzel, though. Mr. Schultz. Fuck.
Schnitzler.
So Simon Schnitz... Shit. So Simon Schnitzler, starting out, we want to kind of know how you got started in the hobby.
Yeah, and just tell us about your kind of like hobby journey and the armies that you've collected over the years.
Okay. I could write a book about that probably, so I will try to break it down to three or four important stations. The first thing that happened in my life was that my aunt bought me Hero Quest for Christmas. And that was the first time I got introduced to those small models, and I loved them to death. Because they were basically all I've been ever dreaming of. Small monsters, dungeons, heroes fighting over whatever goals. That was kind of the fulfillment of my dreams back then. And we played it kind of for ages, and me and my friends loved it. That was the first step that I got introduced into models at that size. The next step was a little story. You can write that down in my biography. I had that girlfriend back in the days when I was, too young to have a serious girlfriend anyhow. And we were going to the movies to see Independence Day. And since we had some time to spend before going to the movie, we wandered around the city and we stumbled across the Games Workshop in Düsseldorf back then. And I was hesitant to go in there. I was totally fascinated, but I was afraid that my girlfriend I had back then would find it strange. And but she saw that I was fascinated by it, and she encouraged me to go inside. And so I just went inside, grabbed a leaflet, and went back and stuffed that into my pocket and looked at it afterwards, and it really fascinated me because it was so new. I had this orcs and goblins and knights and all those fantasy stuff already kind of visually in my life because we had Dungeon Crawler Hero Quest, and suddenly they all turned into sci-fi. It was like this weird mixture of these fantasy archetypes, and you pour a good portion of Transformers and all those sci-fi stuff on this fantasy stuff, which basically 40K is. And asked my parents to buy me something from this strange thing I had no idea about. So we got the starter set for Christmas, and we played all Christmas season, and we infected all our friends, and within 2 weeks all our friends had kind of bought Games Workshop Düsseldorf empty. We were all playing that, but the fun thing was no one actually understood the rules because they were rather complex. There were words in there we couldn't work out, like psychology. What's that supposed to mean, or what's morale? Who cares? But we love this game, and so we played it on and off, and after a while people got bored, and we got interested in other things more than small tabletop things. And the next time I kind of got back to that was when some friends of mine restarted HeroQuest, because we were older, I don't know, 14, 15, something like that. Well, probably 15. And we started playing HeroQuest again. And so I started thinking about how cool this was to play 40K, and then I got back into that. And I think the next big thing that happened was the Eye of Terror summer campaign, because that really got me into going back to the store every week or every 2 days, and it was during summer, so I had holidays and I could go really often back to the store, and that was the first time I really understood the game, how all was supposed to work. So I made this first experience with my Chaos Space Marines. I played Slaanesh, and that was when I started converting. Actually, there was this dude in the store called Velf, which his parents thought was funny because his name was W-E-L-F, which stands for Wind, Earth, and Fire in German. And so they called him Welf. But he was a well-known guy in Games Workshop Germany, and he was a crazy good artist. And he introduced me into sculpting and how to use green stuff properly. And so I started converting, and yes, I played my Slaanesh army to the very end of the campaign, and it was really all going for chaos and stuff like that. And that got me into converting stuff.
Simon, do you remember the very first model that you actually converted?
The very first model, yes. I sadly remember that, because I had this phase when I was convinced that Games Workshop wanted so much of my money that I was trying to deny them my money whenever I could. And I went to the store, and they were talking about this magical green stuff and how it could turn wonderfully into rock solid from putty to plastic hardness. And I didn't want to spend my money on green stuff. I wanted to spend my money on models. But I wanted to convert them, and I had this undead army, which was a crazy mixture of my HeroQuest skeletons and all I could put my hands on at that time, and some ordinary models. And I wanted to have, I don't know, these undead riders, which had horses, but not bears, skeleton horses, but they were wearing kind of armor and carapace and stuff like that. And I took this plasticine, and I kind of modeled armor plates on those horses. And in order to get it solid, I covered the plasticine in super glue, which resulted in really weird, crappy looking armor shit hanging off those poor skeleton horses. Nowadays, I know that the super glue reacted probably with the fat in the plasticine and kind of got rock solid really soon. But underneath the super glue, it was still movable. And so it was... That's really my first conversion. It was really crappy, yes.
I think that everyone has that experience of using shitty clay because you can't get the good stuff. Like, when I first started converting, I was using plumber's putty, which is like epoxy putty, but it hardens very, very quickly. I bought it, again, like you said, because green stuff was too expensive and I needed that money for models. So I went to, and it was like hard to get a lot of green stuff back then. I guess I didn't know how to find it on the internet. But I went to just the home hardware, whatever, store where you buy stuff for fixing your house, and I got epoxy putty, and it was horrible. It would set in about 20 minutes, so you had very little time to work with it. And then it was, like, rock hard.
I think with sculpting, when you throw in, like, a time-sensitive element, you have to focus on it in a very limited amount of time.
I guess you have to get shit done quick. Well, one of the problems with sculpting is that you can always go back and second-guess what you did. And kind of like revise it. So that stops you from being able to do that. And oftentimes when you do that, you screw up something you did well the first time.
Ah. Did the plumber's putty get so hot that it melted the plastic you were putting it on?
I was mostly working with pewter back then because that was back in the day. So this is when I was sculpting the Carnifex, the Hell Carnifex. I don't remember it melting the plastic. I don't think it got that hot, but it got pretty hot. It was uncomfortable to touch. It got that hot. Did you ever have an experience like that?
I did. I'm still using it today because when you want to have something as an under construction, you can cover later with green stuff and put more details on. I'm still using that because it cures so quickly, and this is very very good because I'm impatient and I want to get stuff done quickly.
You're one of the most impatient sculptors I know. You're the one who taught me that if I put something under a lamp, it'll cure faster and I can get on with it.
Yeah. But what I realized is that you can mix different putties and vary the substance and the curing time. So you could use plumber putty and mix it with green stuff and have maybe half an hour or 45 minutes until it cures.
That's the hardest thing with green stuff, I think, when you're modeling, is like you start work on one part, you finish that, and you're like, oh, I still got a bunch of green stuff. I'm going to move on to this part that I got to work on. And then you're working on it, and all your other fingers are bumping into the thing you just made perfect.
That happens so often.
Yeah, one of the reasons that I'm glad we're talking to Simon is that Simon taught me most of what I know about green stuff and sculpting. And one thing he taught me for dealing with that is that if you put putty in the freezer, you mix up your green stuff and then you immediately put it in the freezer, you can use that green stuff for like 1 to 2 days after, maybe more, but it starts to cure a little bit. But wait, we should go back to Simon's story because I feel like he didn't finish it. He talked about his Space Marines, but... I feel like you did most of your amazing stuff after that.
Yeah, I never published any of those Lanish conversions, which I actually should at some point, because until today, I'm...
Send me pictures. I'll put them in a video.
I will do that, because some of them... that was the first time I really engaged the Golden Demon competition, and I built that Noise Marine Rhino, where I had this 10 technical... So there was a Noise Marine band on that Rhino, and they were having drums and all this crazy stuff. That was the craziest year on Golden Demon that ever went down, because that year the category was Monster Vehicle 40K, and they were having this together, and the jury decided that none of the stuff that was entered reached the quality a Golden Demon should have, and so they didn't place any first or second. The only one who got something was a Gene Stealer Patriarch, who got third place.
That was a dick move.
That was a dick move, and it was never repeated again. And I was so devastated that year. I was so fucking angry because I had put so much work into this, and the whole store was contributing a conversion bid, and oh yeah, I got this for so. it was basically a community project that time. And everyone was donating bits and pieces and stuff like that for me to make it happen. And it was obviously Slanish black and pink. And they argued that I didn't highlight the black. That was the reason it didn't win. And it was like, yeah, that's no argumentation. This is really bullshit. And it angers me until today, because I think if you think about any sports thing, if someone reaches the goal 1.5 hours before the others, the second and the third still get a medal, right? And so that was that point. I was frustrated back then, but I took it as a challenge to get the Golden Demon one day. And it took me just 7 years of constant repeating entries every year and again until I won the first time anything.
Wait, how many Golden Demons have you won?
Since then, I have 7, I think.
That's pretty good.
And for every year I tried and failed, I got me a demon.
later, yeah.
Yeah, well, the next big step was probably I was getting back into the hobby again for the I don't know which time through Tyranids. And when they got redone in third edition, I grabbed the White Dwarf where they were introduced on the last page, and I still where they had this preview page, and I still can remember this impact this Tyranid Warrior image had on me, and I was like, this is going to be my next big thing, and I need to have these, and then I started Tyranids. But I got beaten to death with them over and over again because Tyranids back then were kind of hard to play. They didn't have Carnifexes. They had this just very expensive, very ugly metal Carnifex no one wanted to play. And I got beaten to death with them so often that I kind of stopped playing Tyranids. At one point later, I kind of restarted Tyranids, and then was I was working with Games Workshop then, and that was the time I got access to large quantities of models for affordable price. And that was no stopping me back then, because they got the Gene Stealers redone and the new Codex, and that was me. And the Carnifex, of course, yes. And that was me going to town with Tyranids. And that was and still is my big love with 40K.
And what other armies did you collect?
I had, at some point, Dark Eldar. And I played Gene Stealer Cult when there was no Gene Stealer Cult.
What rules did you use to play them back then?
Imperial Guard. But because at that time I started, since I converted every single model, I wanted to play just smaller games. I was kind of fed up with this massive, huge armies clashing together, which always felt kind of weird. That was the time I started for smaller games.
Simon, was there anything else you wanted to say about your like journey in the hobby?
Well, yeah, basically at some point, it was the time that Games Workshop closed Games Workshop Germany, and that was the point I kind of left Games Workshop. Since all my other friends were kind of kicked off, that was the time that I emotionally kind of broke with Games Workshop. Because such a big love can turn into such a big disappointment. And it feels I'd never gotten over it this properly. So I'm still hoarding all my stuff, but I don't have any big intention to do big stuff with that. And I kickstarted Sedition Wars, and that was my first going rogue thing into a different approach, a kind of cleaner sci-fi thing.
That's Studio McVeigh, right?
Yes, it was an amazingly cool game, but it kind of it was overwhelmed by the Kickstarter success, and it's down basically. It's kind of sad because the idea was great, the game was great, and everything. The models were awesome. The basic idea is that you have kind of this sci-fi human race thing, kind of if you think. Kind of advanced technology humans with cool armor suits and weapons and stuff like that. And the other side was called the Strain. They were kind of this nano-biological techno-war thing that turned dead people into sci-fi zombie things. There was this accident on the secret research facility thing, and there the Strain got into consciousness and started to convert dead people into these zombie things, but it also evolved into this biotechnological monsters, which it's a really unique design behind those things that I've never seen in any other game system before and afterwards. It's really cool. And it sadly got shut down because they couldn't write rules that were actually working really well, because McVeigh was obviously more into making models. And that was really sad, but we played it and we played it and we played it, and at some point the rules and the scenarios and the storyline was over, and we were at the point that we either should develop our own storyline or we should turn to something else. And so we thought, well, we were always interested in Infinity by Corvus Belli, and which had really similar design in some ways, and so we thought, well, let's give this a shot. And it was like the renaissance of my tabletop emotions, because it felt like starting second edition again. I was buying miniatures. I had no clue what they could do on the battlefield. Like, I remember that my brothers gave me for Christmas a rocket launcher model, and I texted my friend I was playing Infinity with, like, oh yeah, I got a rocket launcher for Christmas. I have no idea what it's going to do, if it's worth it or not, but I have a rocket launcher. And he texted me back, and I got a sniper for Christmas. Let's see how they do. And it was that was really, really cool. And I've been bigly in love with Infinity back then, because it feels like everything Games Workshop has done wrong in the past, well, they're doing a lot of things right now, but in the past Games Workshop has done really a lot of things wrong, and Corvus Belli have done exactly these points right. For example, Corvus Belli is listening to the community. There's this, don't sell army books, because all the army profiles are online for free. And so they have this army builder tool called Army 5 or 6 or something. And you can have mercenaries. And I love the idea of sci-fi mercenaries. And I was complaining about that you couldn't include in the newest version of this army, you couldn't include the mercenaries in the proper way. And so I started a little thread in the international forum complaining about that. And after 2 weeks, they said, oh, you want, I was advertising for Merc button on the army thing. And after 2 weeks, they said, you want a Merc button. And here you go. Here you have a Merc button. Now you can introduce them into your thing. Or there's this legendary unit called Fat Juan Juan. Juan Juans are kind of space pirate mercenaries, and at some point the community had some dossier concept artwork of a Fat Juan Juan, and since then always people have proclaimed that they wanted this Fat Juan Juan unit. And the recent release from Corvus Belli has been this Fat Juan Juan, like these super fat dudes falling from the sky with their rocket backpacks, and it's like they're really close to the community, and they're listening to what people kind of want, and that's a really good thing, I guess, because a community can produce a lot of shitty ideas, but they also can produce a lot of awesome ideas, and they're using the social medias wisely. Like promoting different blogs and promoting different topics in the forums and stuff like that. That's really cool.
Should we get back to like your sculpting questions? I feel like we've kind of gone on a tangent.
Yeah, I got a couple questions for yous.
Oh, I just want to talk about different materials. We all started talking about this kind of plasticine, modeler's clay. In German, what was it called, Simon?
Knete.
Knete. So I really like this material, and I did a little bit of research on it. When it first was produced, it was in 1900s. Everybody was making their own kind of version of this clay that wasn't water-based, so it wouldn't dry out, so it could be continually used. And they were all gray-white colors. And when you use it, you get a kind of oily feeling on your hand. It's because 10% of it is petroleum jelly, and it comes off on your hands and leaves you a little bit greasy. But I love this material starting out. It's eternally, when it gets heated up, it gets very, very soft and very malleable. But even from, if you haven't touched it, it's still pretty soft. You can use it 1,000 times, and the only problem is that oiliness to it. I think it's the best thing to, like, throw at your kid if you're like, hey, you want to try sculpting? Use that. Don't get it on my action figures.
If you want to start modeling, start early and start with plasticine.
What about you, Simon? What's your favorite sculpting material?
I think it still is and always will be green stuff. Green stuff is good for creating really small details. But what you can do with green stuff is mix it with other components. You can mix it with epoxy sculpt if you need more value, because epoxy sculpt is obviously way cheaper than green stuff. You can mix it with magic sculpt, which is a bit like epoxy sculpt. It's just finer. If you want to sculpt something that is sandable, you should mix it with either magic sculpt or epoxy sculpt. Then green stuff really gets rock solid, and you can use sandpaper on it. But you can also go and mix green stuff with Fimo. Fimo is probably known as this plasticine that you can put into an oven.
Oh, no, it's Fimo. It's Fimo here as well. That's the brand name.
Okay. Well, if you mix green stuff with Fimo at a ratio of always more green stuff than Fimo, you can create something really smooth. You can smooth out things really good, and it always will stay a bit of will keep a rest flexibility, which is awesome for if you want to do coats on models. If you mix it with epoxy sculpt and it gets rock solid, it's easier to break off. If it's a little bit softer, it stays a bit softer with Fimo. You can
They bend before they break?
Yes, exactly.
What was I going to say? Oh, you told me to use the Fimo with the green stuff a while ago, Simon. I haven't been doing it recently, but I have made the mistake of putting too much Fimo in, and then it just never cures, which is not good. So important to, if you're going to try that, only use more green stuff than Fimo.
Have you ever used Sculpty?
No.
It's like Fimo. I used it a while ago. So, like, I was making a mask, and I left it for too long, came back and tried to work on it again, and it just crumbled to pieces. If you're using Fimo or Sculpty, you think, oh, it's going to be malleable until I bake it. The problem is Fimo and Sculpty need to be hot to be malleable, and if they cool down and you want to come back and keep molding it, it's not going to be as soft because it won't be as hot, and it'll crack and break.
Yeah. Go with epoxy sculpt. You don't have to heat up the oven. I actually hate putting anything into the oven because you can't do that for, I don't know, if you're using it on plastic models. Yeah, for obvious reasons, it won't work.
I think he and I have fights over this where he likes baking stuff and I can't stand baking stuff, so I don't like using clay or anything that needs to be baked.
Well, I really like ceramic clay. The things we make out of plastic and epoxy and whatever, models, they'll last a long time, but they're still pretty fragile in a lot of ways. And there's like a layer of paint on top that could chip and get peeled off and whatever. But ceramic, it's lasted hundreds of years, so it's kind of got a timeless quality.
Yeah. You're making rocks at that point. I didn't get to my favorite material. And as Simon stole green stuff, I should probably say epoxy sculpt. I think I actually like epoxy sculpt more than green stuff. I can never work without green stuff. Everything I sculpt is a mix of epoxy sculpt and green stuff, but it's just, I feel like I really came into my own with sculpting was when I was making Tyranid scenery for this big board that we did for Games Day back when they still had Games Day in Canada. I feel like I never would have sculpted that Tyranid scenery if I was just using green stuff, because I would have been frustrated by how much green stuff I had to mix up. Keep adding more green stuff, keep adding more green stuff, and how much that cost. When you find epoxy sculpt and you can get like 4 pounds of epoxy sculpt for a little more than you'd pay for like two sets of tubes of green stuff, you aren't worried as much anymore. Like, there's an element to worry, like, oh, well, I'm going to buy all this material and then I'm going to waste it. What if I make this thing and it's crap? When you're using epoxy sculpt, you don't really have to worry about that as much because you have so much of it. And if it's crap, well, then just throw it out and mix up some more. So I feel like it's epoxy sculpt is very liberating, like a lot more liberating than green stuff, because you can throw it away without worrying about it.
The problem with epoxy sculpt is the availability. So people of epoxy sculpt, if you're listening to it, make it easier accessible all over the world, because I'm still feasting on those stuff I bought a couple of years ago in Canada. And it's so hard to get in Germany. Guys, Would you be mad at me if we continue this at another time?
No problem, man.
Because I need to kind of take the dog for a walk.
Yeah, sure, no problem. Yeah, it's a good idea. We'll stop now, and I'll edit it up. We can make it a 2-part episode for sure. Well, thank you so much, Simon. Thank you for taking time.
Yeah, thanks, Simon.
Awesome. Well, Nick, I wish you a good day. Mr. Jones, I wish you a good night. And I will have a good day. Awesome. Smell you later, guys.
Splice into the infranet using an old junction point. He has concluded his communication. Attention, be advised, the Turk is on the move. Do not engage. He will likely descend to your level to access the gantries leading to the CapEx spire. Belay that order. I'm not sure how, but Gladius has sensed your presence. He knows you're there. This is visual confirmation. The target has just ingested the Silicrete data wafer. Lethal force is permitted, but it is paramount that you recover the body. I repeat, take him out, but only if you're certain